Hey everybody, welcome to It Never Rains on this podcast. I'm Hithloday. I'm the managing editor for Addicted to Quack. It's a website. Joining me this week is one of the great writers for ATQ, Slurms Matt Court. How you doing?
I'm very well. Yourself?
Oh, not bad. So we are finally exiting the doldrums, as we call them around here. Oregon athletics is, you know, our bread and butter. And, you know, we like to cover, you know, when Oregon athletics plays, and they don't do that much during July and August. But women's soccer has started up. We're offering coverage, you know, every time they play. We had two different articles about media availabilities from Badwater, who's been doing a great job bulldogging this stuff, including, you know, getting an interview with head coach Graham Abel, which is, you know, yeah, pretty insightful.
I thought that was really important, because having that kind of access and willingness for coaching staffs and perhaps in some cases even players, it can really help with the insights into what's going on in the programs.
Sure. And like, you know, you're not going to get a better source for, you know, strengths and weaknesses of the program than the coach himself, you know.
Absolutely.
And next up in terms of getting started is women's volleyball. We'll be just as aggressive in covering that. And then football starts shortly thereafter. Right now the Ducks football team is in fall camp. We've been getting daily practice reports, which are, you know, there's a bit of a Pravda element to them. They are sort of state news. But Slurms, you have been sifting through the practice reports to find the nuggets of wisdom, and you've got an article that's going to be going up tomorrow. We're recording this on Friday night. Slurms, your article is going to be going up on Saturday, summarizing the recent Oregon football practices. Why don't you give us a little sneak preview?
Yeah, sure. I'd be happy to. Listen, so the Ducks have basically done about two full weeks of practice. They've had a couple of days off here and there. They've had one scrimmage, which was last Saturday. They'll have a scrimmage tomorrow, Saturday. Again, we're recording on Friday night, so it's tomorrow, where, you know, hopefully what the coaching staff wants is all of the lessons that they've been teaching the last week after the previous scrimmage will be put on the field and tested out to see who is it that has made progress in the areas that the coaching staff is hoping those players will make progress in. One of the things that's coming out of the practice sessions, you're starting to hear this, I think, more and more frequently, is an important thing, and that has to do with player leadership growth. Sometimes in Oregon's football past, you've had teams where the players didn't want to or couldn't figure out how to show leadership. And coaches can teach all they can. They can try to motivate all they want. But what happens on the field is something that comes from the players. And so when you can rise to a level where your players are the ones showing the leadership and they're holding each other accountable rather than the coaching staff having to try to hold them accountable, the players have a chance to get much better very quickly. Because who do we respond to? Mostly we respond to what our peers expect of us. It's similar in some ways, I guess, to, you know, to being in a foxhole with a guy during wartime, and you've got his back and he's got yours, and you have to be able to trust that person to do their job. And so this is where you're starting to see, I think, a lot of growth. And Coach Lupoy talked about this in an interview a couple of days ago, where he's starting to see a lot of that leadership in players start to rise to the surface, and some players growing in their leadership ability. And the main thing that's happening, I think, in some of this is some of these players are gaining leadership opportunities because they're getting the respect of their fellow players by how hard they're working. And that's one of the things that the staff has been emphasizing all along. And it's something I wrote about a week ago in my practice report, is let's work every minute that we have available to practice. Let's not start slow and work up to it. Let's not work hard and then sort of fall off at the end of practice effort-wise. So that's where the staff is trying to get the players, and having player leadership is one of the great ways to get that to happen.
Coach, go ahead. No, you.
Well, you know, it's interesting on the subject of player leadership. You know, I come at football from film study. You can't see leadership on film study.
Right.
And so, you know, I am inclined sort of, you know, often sort of dismiss that stuff. But then, you know, when I break stuff down, you know, and having done this for a long time, like, you can, there is simply a different level of performance between teams that are made up of young hotshots and teams that are full of veterans, even if those veterans are a little less talented. You know, leadership doesn't totally make up for talent. Like, if there's a yawning talent void, you know, it doesn't matter how much, right, you know, veteran status you've got, you're going to get creamed by the superior athletes if they're that much better than you. But it is nonetheless the, you know, ceteris paribus. You know, if I'm looking at two equally talented teams, but one of them, you know, you can definitely see, you know, the veterans. And also the other thing about doing film study and like, you know, that I'll chip in here on that subject is that, like, there's a lot of on-field communication that happens that you don't necessarily pick up on when you're watching in real time. But, like, right, when you're rewatching plays or watching them in slow motion, you can see the sort of communication. And there are definitely, like, more voluble and communicative, you know, team members, especially you see it on the defense, where, you know, you got to be able to instantaneously react to what's happening. It's sort of spreading around, like, oh, look, that dude's in motion. That means this is going to happen and you need to fall back into that coverage and you need to spin down, you know, like you are actually able to see that on film.
That's one of the things that Jeff Bassa talked about. As far as communication goes, he's trying to be more vocal. But the other thing he was saying is, from a leadership standpoint, he's trying to learn to recognize the sets that the offense has. And they've seen this before, and we know what they're going to do out of this set, or approximately what they're going to do, and get in the play calling from him to the rest of the defense earlier, so that guys have more of a chance to, you know, another second or two or whatever it is, to think about, this is what happened the last time this play was run.
Yeah. So for anybody who sort of, you know, I understand the impulse to sort of roll your eyes at that sort of stuff, because it kind of sounds like coach speak. And a lot of times that's kind of just nonsense, you know, or to cover up, you know, not wanting to give away state secrets. Right. You sort of talk about fluffy stuff like that. But, like, no, at least an element of that. No, it's real. You know, like, you know, veteran leadership is worthwhile. And does, you know, provide real value. And it's a game of split seconds, and it's a game of inches. And if you have one, you know, half a step, you know, faster, you know, half a step, you know, earlier, because you recognize it, or because, you know, a leader on your team has given you some guidance on that. Yeah, that's the difference between, you know, stopping the play and letting the play go big on defense, or, mm-hmm, or, you know, the other way around on offense. Yeah, it's real. You know, it's not, you know, it's not worth talking about 100% of the time, which is what, you know, some of the podcasts I listen to, and it, you know, makes me, you know, ball my fists in rage, because I'm like, why the hell do film study if that's the only thing you need to talk about? You know, it certainly is not totally predictive of games. You know, I watch,
no,
and in fact, I've seen the opposite happen all the time. You know, there's a team to Oregon's North that I think, you know, for years overvalued, you know, senior leadership versus, you know, young talent, and dug themselves in a hole as a result of that. You can definitely take it too far, but it is a real phenomenon, and it is good to see, and is good to hear people talking about. And the last thing I'll say on the subject of leadership, because I want to ask you a couple more questions about how practices are going, is that, like, you know, for a while there, you know, Oregon was in a real recruiting hole, you know, starting around, you know, 2016, you know, the 2015 class was a decent class, but so many of those dudes were busts. And then the 2016 class was sort of a nightmare. And it was, you know, arguably, in my opinion, one of the biggest reasons that people don't really talk about that much, that Mark Helfrich got fired, is just the recruiting had fallen off so badly. And that, you know, Oregon had a number of players who came in 2016, you know, like Justin Herbert, like Troy Dye, you know, who were like, you know, who were like heroes of that era, that, you know, you know, but we're talking about, you know, not to besmirch them or anything, but like a lot of times for Oregon over the last 5 years or so, your veteran leaders and your guys who went through hell, you know, in that horrible 4-8 season, and that, you know, the real, you know, the character that built, you're talking about 3 stars. And who are the veteran leaders for the Oregon 2022 football program? They're 5 stars like Noah Sewell. You know,
right.
they're 5 stars like Bo Nix. You know, I don't, you know, it's not like I played, you know, Division I college football. I don't really know what it's like when a 5-star is your leader. And if that is demonstrably different than when, like, you know, again, I'm not taking shots at anybody, but like, you know, one of the defensive leaders through the 2020 and 2021 seasons was Jordan Happel, who was, you know, basically a walk-on, right? Or Nate Heakalani, who was sort of forced into service as a senior walk-on. And like, I don't know, man. I think it's probably is different when you're getting your leadership from a dude who's like, who can talk the talk, but who can't walk the walk as well as you can as a young hotshot. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Like, yeah. Now, you talked earlier about, you know, respecting talent versus respecting leadership. And that's, I mean, somebody like Bo Nix, you might respect him because he's vocal in practice. I mean, whatever it is, he's working, he's doing the job, he's working hard and so forth. But on the other hand, you can respect the guy because he's a talent. And when you come in as a 5-star, that is just a different level than a lot of these athletes are currently at. Doesn't mean they can't get there over the long term. But just the fact that the guy is super talented, these players will recognize that as something else to respect that brings leadership.
Yeah, I mean, it just strikes me as, you know, that must be an interesting dynamic when it's like, dude, the person who's telling me what to do is super talented and he's been around the program for 3 years, you know, and has gone through all of this stuff. Like, I suspect it probably hits different, you know, if you're a true freshman and you're getting, you know, that kind of, you know, treatment. It's just like, yeah, if you're getting that from Noah Sewell, like that's probably something a little different than getting that from Nate Heakalani, I suspect.
I'm sure it is.
So the other sort, you know, always is hot topic for fall practices, how the quarterback battle is going. Have you been able to parse any of the practice reports as to how, you know, what the status of that race is?
Well, this is an area where you get tons of coach speak, as you said, and, you know, nobody wants to give anything away. And I think to some degree you don't want to disincentivize the guys that you don't see as the starter from continuing to work hard. You have to have them believe that they've got a shot at, if not the starting role, then the number two shot and maybe some backup, you know, snaps in actual games. You know, one of the things that Coach Lanning has said repeatedly is that he believes he has more than one quarterback that the Ducks can win with. So that says a couple of things. One is, well, maybe the quarterback is why you're winning, and or maybe the quarterback is not hurting you so badly that you can't win. But I, you know, I would say that
it's better to be in that situation, the opposite situation, or one of the many opposite situations. It's better to be in that situation than, like, we got to find the best of a bunch of bad options.
Right.
Which, who frankly, hurts us? I think is what the school up north is probably looking at.
Yeah.
And like all these guys have a big knock on them. Which one can I live with is probably how those guys are looking at it right now. And like, I don't think that's what the case at Oregon is. And, or like, oh, man, you know, only one of these guys can play. I got to identify him, and then I got to cross my fingers that no one ever gets, you know, in trouble at all. You know, this situation, yeah. You know, it looks like he's got three dudes who could totally win, and it's just figuring out, like, okay, which one is a little bit better than the other two, mm-hmm. You know, like that's the situation that you want, you know.
Not a terrible problem to have if it's coach speak, but if Coach Lanning really believes that he can win with the quarterbacks, plural, which is how he's been phrasing it, he has in the room, then that's a great situation to be in. And, I think Nix still has to be the odds on favorite to start the Georgia
game. Well, he's just so much vastly more experienced than the other
that's
guys.
That's the thing. I mean, it's nobody, he is hopefully, I wouldn't think, going to be intimidated by the setting or the size of the game or any of the stuff that goes on before these gigantic season openers between two highly ranked teams. He's been there. There's no reason for him to, you know, to have any weird adverse reaction to you know, playing against Georgia in a big game like that. And that's, yeah, you know, that alone.
He's played against Georgia for the last 3 years, you know.
Exactly. Like,
the other thing is just sort of political, you know, like, you know, if Nix is selected and Nix has been, you know, pretty vocal about, like, this is my last year playing college ball, even though he's going to have eligibility after this year remaining, is that, like, it preserves all your options, right? Like,
right.
You know, technically, Ty Thompson and because 2020 was a COVID, was a holiday year, Ty Thompson and Jay Butterfield are both redshirt freshmen. Right. You know, they have all their eligibility still ahead of them. And they've got Dante Moore, the five-star, coming in. If Nix is selected and he, you know, plays his 1 year and then leaves, then you have three young quarterbacks who get to battle it out. And of course, all of them, you know, bet on themselves. On the other hand, if Thompson or Butterfield is selected, you know, Nix sort of sits on the bench and hopes somebody gets hurt, which is not a great situation. Whoever of the two freshmen is not selected is got to be like, well, that dude's got to have the job for the next couple of years. And I've got Dante Moore coming in behind me. Like, mm-hmm. That dude's going to feel the squeeze and transfer out.
Absolutely. There's certainly no guarantee. Nix can say whatever he wants about, eligibility and one and done and all of that. But there's no guarantee that's what's going to happen.
Well, but, you know, what I'm saying is that, like, if Thompson is selected, then Butterfield's going to be like, well, between even if Nix, assuming that Nix does leave, but even if he stays, staying is worse, right? Like, staying mm-hmm. is just like, dude, now I've got to compete against three dudes and one of the freshmen, you know, got the job, you know, or vice versa. Butterfield is selected, right. You know, then Thompson, you know, transfers out because he doesn't want to be in a squeeze between the you know, a young starter and, you know, hotshot, you know, true freshman coming in. Whereas, you know, go with Nix and it sort of solves those, you know, it preserves all of your options. So, like, just like Nix's experience, I think, acts as a tiebreaker, I also think sort of the politics acts as a tiebreaker that, like, so my expectation is that the coaches are never going to say this, but my expectation is that unless the gap between Thompson / Butterfield above Nix is enormous, that you shouldn't select one of them. You should select Nix. Like, you should, or to put it another way, you should select Nix unless you believe that you can't win with Nix. And so right. As long as they are saying we can win with Nix, then, like, I feel like that's the safe bet.
Yeah. And it will surprise me if he is not the starter at Georgia, period.
All right. We'll look forward to your article tomorrow. There's a lot more to discuss as well. We've seen reports about, you know, some offensive line injuries. We've seen, you know, some reports about how, you know, different position battles. And I look forward to reading your article about all that. All right. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll talk about some of the fall camp battles that are going around the Pac-12. Okay, so over the course of the spring and summer, I was writing duck dive previews into all the different Pac-12 teams, including Oregon. And I've been keeping an eye on all the fall camp practices, you know, all of the little news releases and folks who are off the team and unexpected, you know, so forth. So, like, that's going to be my article for next week is, you know, lots of little updates, you know, around the Pac-12. And I'll give my season record predictions, you know, now that I'll have full information coming out of fall camp. It's been an interesting ride throughout the summer. You know, a lot of teams are dealing with the transfer portal in different ways. You know, a lot of folks are suddenly losing kids that they were counting on through the transfer portal. A lot of teams are like getting kids in through the transfer portal that like weren't in place for spring practice, which is like that's always interesting, you know, and to go through spring practice and be like, uh-oh, we need to plug a hole here. Probably the most significant in terms of, you know, both directions is Arizona State. Like, boy, what a roller coaster. You know, in hindsight, it was probably a mistake to do those. I wrote my article about Arizona State the second, number two in the order. And like immediately after, you know, I wrote my articles, a bunch of transfer actions that happened. You know, so like they lost a defensive lineman, Omar Norman Lott, but then he decided, I think, to come back. They had a, they added another, you know, JUCO, who's unrated. On the other hand, they lost a defensive lineman, Mattis, for the season with an ACL injury, and one of their dudes was arrested on a DUI in which and the collision that was involved with, he killed a pedestrian. You know, that guy's not on the roster now. There's a couple other guys in the linebacking corps who transferred out, a defensive back, you know, transferred out. There's a tight end that they're missing. So it's like, you know, immediately after I wrote my article, they got one really good, piece of news, which was, you know, Norman Lott coming back. And then like a bunch of really bad news, and like, boy, ASU is not in a position to take, you know, bad news. Like, oh my God, man, boy, that program.
Yeah. I don't know what you do about, you know, some of these things are just, you can't even say they're self-inflicted. So some of it's just bad luck that happens to your squad. And it's like, how do you prepare for some of these things? I don't know.
Yeah, you know, a kid suffering an ACL tear in camp, you know, like that just sucks, you know.
All you can do is, you know, all you can do is try through strength and conditioning to get your athletes to the point where those sorts of injuries are less likely to happen. You're going to have all kinds of weird injuries. We've seen it certainly
but,
at Oregon.
I mean, you can't eliminate any of it. And like, you also, you know, you can't blame people for their injuries. Like, all of them are out there practicing hard.
Yeah.
And that's the way that you want it. It's just like, it's a physical, violent game, you know, like, you know, stuff like that. It's to some extent is inevitable. On the other hand, like driving drunk, that's not inevitable. You know,
That's true.
And you know, I don't want to be too hasty to like connect dots here in terms of like the, you know, the program culture at ASU and be like, well, Herm Edwards is ultimately responsible for Stanley Lambert's DUI arrest. But like, you know, culture and discipline is a thing.
It is.
And for a pedestrian to lose their life in a DUI, you know, is a tragedy. And it's, you know, frankly, you know, it's absurd and painful for us to be talking about it on a sports podcast. But like, you know, one of the reasons why we have college athletics is that it is supposed to, you know, enrich young people's lives and make their experiences better and make them better men and women. And like, that's the opposite of that is what's happening when somebody gets a DUI and harms someone else. I'm not here to say that, you know, in another world in which Herm Edwards was a, you know, had a firmer control that like some of these, you know, awful events wouldn't happen. But like, there are definitely some awful things that have been happening with Arizona State, you know, in which, you know, this is the Piper getting paid. And as I, you know, I keep saying on this podcast, whenever we talk about other programs, we're ultimately really talking about Oregon. Like, you know, I have to say I've been pretty happy with the way that Oregon has been running its program for, you know, for about as long as I can remember. You know, there have been tragedies, there have even been deaths. But like, you know, I don't see Urban Meyer stuff going on at Oregon, and I'm pretty happy about that.
No, Oregon, you know, has I think, you know, it learned the lesson of some of the things that happened when Chip Kelly was here, where you had a few players get a little bit out of control. And I think that the more recent coaching staffs have put a little higher premium on, you know, the quality of the young man that they're recruiting. And, you know, a lot of times you can talk to the folks that know them from their high school and from their communities and find out a lot about them, what kind of young man that they are for when they come and play football for your school. And so you can weed out some of those problems before they happen. That does not mean that people don't get in college and go sideways, because that certainly happens too.
Yeah, I guess I put it this way. You know, Oregon under Mario Cristobal recruited a couple of kids who were like, did not wind up making it to Eugene because they did some pretty horrible stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, and your ability to, you know, I don't know, I think reasonable people can disagree about your ability to detect that sort of thing in someone's character, a young man's character, before it happens. Like, I think there are some people who could make pretty persuasive arguments that you can. I think there are some other people who could make some pretty persuasive arguments that you cannot. But, mm-hmm. you know, what I, you know, the, to me, you know, as a fan of the institution and the athletics programs that it fields, the important thing is they didn't play at Oregon. You know, it's like nobody was making excuses for those guys. And like, you know, Oregon's first trip to the playoffs was, you know, against a Florida State team where, you know, I can tell you from having studied that team a lot, not just on the field stuff, but like I had to keep track of all of them throughout the news, was just like there wasn't really any institutional control in that program. There was a lot of stuff that was being swept under the rug at Florida State. And like, you know, I got to say it feels, you know, I'm not trying to like stick my nose up in the air here, but like it feels good to be rooting for a team that feels good to be rooting for, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's not, like, it isn't just winning games, or, you know, winning or losing games. It's a matter of, can you be proud of the program as a whole, not just whether or not the field results are good. I think most Duck fans, you know, the ones that I know anyway, don't want to have a team that, you know, has a lot of off-field problems or, you know, the kinds of things that you see in other programs, and would trade winning games for that. Okay, we'll take some of the bad players who have, you know, these societal problems of one kind or another, and we'll trade that for more wins. I don't think there are many Duck fans, certainly the ones that I know, that would make that kind of a bargain. They'd much prefer.
I mean, I think those fans do exist, man. Like,
I'm sure they do exist. I just don't, they're not the kind of people that I associate with.
Well, good for you, I guess. no, I mean, my point about Florida State was that it was a little farther, you know, I want to take the point farther than that, which is that, like, you know, there were some pretty nasty allegations about, and by nasty, I don't mean the person who was making the allegations was a nasty person. I mean, the subject matter of the allegations was stuff that I don't like to think about. And, you know, the thing that in trying to, like, you know, playing detective, you know, trying to resolve what happened, what I very quickly came to the realization of was that I was never going to get to the bottom of it, because the adults who were supposed to be in the room, everybody from the coach to the athletic department to the police departments, what all of them were interested in excusing that behavior and putting it under the rug, and that, you know, whether the, you know, the quarterback was falsely accused or, you know, correctly accused, our ability to know the truth of that matter was hindered by a bunch of adults who were not acting like adults because football was king. Right. And you know, the order of things was upside down. You know, a 19-year-old or wherever it was kid who threw a football real good, you know, was in charge of the city of Tallahassee. Right. And not the other way around. And like, and that sucks. And it sucks for him too.
Sure.
What's the lesson there? You know, it sucks for everybody because, you know, the you know, not like, boy, I mean, I don't want to apologize for police departments throughout the United States who frequently are dropping the ball on sexual assault allegations. Like, I don't want to say, well, if football wasn't involved, then this would 100% be a totally resolved case to everybody's satisfaction. Because I don't know, man. I don't know about that at all. But like, it was definitely the case that because of, you know, football was king in that, you know, circumstance, that like somebody who probably should have been, you know, had the some sense knocked into him didn't. And, you know, everybody, including that player, you know, pays the price, you know, for it because of pretty backwards priorities, you know, regarding football. And, and I guess, you know, when I look at Oregon, I do think that the program has sometimes, you know, made some excuses for players that they shouldn't have made excuses for. But like, in general, you know, as sort of a general proposition, I don't see that same sort of sickness at Oregon. Yeah, I don't see the same sort of upside down quality to Oregon. And like, that's pretty much the only thing that keeps me going. I think if it ever got upside down like that, where if they were like hiding concussions, you know, or some of the other like real nasty stuff that I've seen, you know, associated with college football, like, I don't know, man, like I might be out, but I'm not, because I think that Oregon is a program that I can feel good about rooting for.
Absolutely.
I hope that continues.
You know, if in the Florida State situation, if the person had not been a football player who allegedly committed this offense, your chances of something happening go way up. Now, like you said, I agree, it's not 100% that something would have happened through the legal system and the court system. But I think the cover-up that took place, protection, I guess, is a better word of that player because of football would not have taken place for anybody else in that society.
I can't come to any other conclusion. And I also come to the conclusion that that's probably not the case at Oregon. I mean, I hope not. Another thing, you know, we got onto the subject because we were talking about, like, you know, all the sort of cultural, you know, problems that are happening at ASU and how that might spill over to like stuff that's not on the football field. You know, I was one of the other like news updates that I learned, you know, as I'm getting ready to write my update article next week about all the different Pac-12 teams is, you know, when we talked to Michael Hanna of the UCLA B team podcast, you know, I was having a hard time sorting out, 'cause the UCLA, the university, was not, you know, it took them forever to post their official roster. They were, you know, 3 months behind everybody else. They finally did on August 4th. And so anyway, but I was talking to Michael, you know, well before that, and I was like, dude, you got to help me out, 'cause you're, you know, you've got more direct access to the program. You got to tell me these kids who are like, is this kid actually on the team? Is this kid not on the team? You know, you got to tell me. And, you know, one of the positions where I was really sort of like, you really got to help me is the offensive line, because there were a bunch of dudes who were apparently not at practices, and UCLA really needs offensive linemen. Particularly, they need offensive tackles. Like, they're really in a jam about this. And, you know, it's pretty salient, you know, to keep track of this. You know, they lost both of their offensive tackles, and they sort of have nobody to replace them. And it was really confusing what the status of their offensive line was. And so I was, you know, grilling Michael, like, is this dude on the team? And it's sort of thrown up in his hands at a couple of these guys. Well, one of them is a guy named Patrick Cole, who was not showing up at practices. Well, the news report that we got is that he's decided to retire from college football after, you know, attempting suicide.
Oh.
And And, but, you know, he feels like, well, he feels like retiring from football is appropriate for him. And he feels like, you know, that more mental health, you know, support, you know, is something that he needs. And, you know, what I was, you know, when I learned about this, you know, I was looking around, you know, for confirmation, you know, and in commentary, and I was dreading a little bit checking out, you know, UCLA forums and Twitter and so forth to, you know, because there was part of me that was expecting to see a bunch of, like, you know, calling them soft and some other names. And I didn't see a single iota of that. Not at all. Like, in fact, I kind of got morbidly curious about it, and I kept digging. You know, I was trying to find, like, well, let me see if I can find the worst human being in the world who'd say, you know, something awful about it. I couldn't find a single one. You know, I really, like, I guess this is like West Coast triumphalism segment of the podcast, but, like, I really feel like, you know, that sort of made me feel proud by reference. You know, so, you know, UCLA is ditching the Pac-12, so I don't know why I'm going to feel proud of a Pac-12 team that doesn't want to be in the Pac-12 anymore, but like I don't know, maybe feel good as a West Coaster, maybe, you know. It's just like the, yeah, you know, like there's been a lot of, like, bitching about the Pac-12, you know, like the SEC's motto is it just means more, and the, like, clever Pac-12 retort is like, here it means, you know, just about the right amount. Like, this is the amount that you should be crazy about college football and not anymore. And, like, but, you know, I'll turn that from a joke to, like, a serious statement. Yeah, that's exactly how you should approach a player who's going through mental health, you know, issues and a suicide attempt. And, like, I felt pretty proud of the UCLA, you know, fan base. It was, like, you know, good for you guys.
Well, it does show that aspect of society and college sports specifically, the mental health of the people involved in these sports and otherwise, has become a focus in recent months and years. And that is the reaction that I think you would be hoping for. But when they started out with this and thought, you know, we need to do something about the acceptance of people that need additional support mentally to do these, whatever they are, to go to college, to play on one of the teams, et cetera. I think that response that you found, which is no one coming forward and saying, ah, this guy's just weak, you know, he's a loser, would be what they would hope for, that is how people should treat it. And so it's encouraging. I agree. I think it's encouraging that, you know, the UCLA fan base, broadly drawn, reacted the way that they did.
The last thing that I'll note before we move on to a different subject, you know, that I'm going to be covering in my article updating all the Pac-12 teams, is Oregon finally released their official heights and weights. You know, I don't know why it took them so long to do so. It seemed like they had released one that was earlier in the off season, but, like, it was all wrong. It was like DBs were listed at 300 pounds. It was like, no, this can't be right. You know, like, someone made a clerical error. Wow. And then they took it down, and I figured it's like, oh, it's gonna be a day, and they're gonna find the little, like, oh, you know, all the cells were incremented down one, oops, you know, or something like that. But then it didn't take a day, it took months. You know, they had an accurate player list. You know, this wasn't a UCLA thing where they just won't tell you who's on the team. They told you who's on the team, they just didn't have any weights. And so anyway, you know, pretty much everybody's weights were at what I expected them to be, you know, that, and all of them were, I think, or sort of appropriate to their positions. There's sort of, like, two interesting notes. One is that, like, sort of across the board, the linebackers has been getting a little slimmer, which, like, makes sense with this defensive structure. They definitely want the linebackers to be faster. And the other thing that I noted was just, it was interesting because I specifically noted it in my article that there's a defensive lineman for Oregon, Trevor Mae, who, you know, it's crazy. I think he's put on 70 pounds since he arrived at Oregon.
What?
But it's like every spring game that I see him, he gains like 30 pounds. Jeez. It's crazy. So anyway, his official weight at the time that the spring game was played was like 249 pounds, and I specifically tagged it in my article, mm-hmm. you know, when I wrote about Oregon, I think in June, that was like, look, I believe that this guy is either going to be a first string or rotational defensive lineman, but he can't be that at 250 pounds. But I also watched him in the spring game, and there's no way that he's 250 pounds. I think that he's probably 270 to 275. And we just need to wait for the official roster to give us, you know, what his weigh-in, you know, is. But I expect it's going to be somewhere in that range, and then he'll be fine. And so, sure enough, you want to guess what his weight was on the official roster?
275.
272. Right in the middle of the range that I guess. Wow. So apparently this is a skill that I've developed over years of doing film studies. You know,
you'll always be able to work in a carnival.
Yeah, exactly. If exactly. If all else fails, I can go work in a carnival as a guess your weight person, assuming that you are a college student who likes playing college football.
Step right up.
All right, let's take a break. We come back. We will talk about, I think, for the third week running, more tales of the Georgia film study. All right, so here's what the chronology for my Georgia film study was. I first did a crash course on Georgia's defense because I needed to write a Dan Lanning article, like a theory mm-hmm. of right. the defense, you know, kind of deal. But I pretty specifically, you know, I wanted to get the principles of it. I didn't want to put together like a highlight reel, you know, of like, here's what their fantastic players can do. And then the other sort of problem is that like they're losing a whole lot of their best players on the defense. So like, you know, what I said to myself was like, okay, I'm going to do that. And then I'm going to do the offense, and then I'm going to come back and do the defense with like a fine tooth comb, because what I really need to do is pick out the returning players and figure out if those guys are any good. So like, that's been this whole process, is like I watched enough of their defense to be able to write an article about the theory of their defense. And then I did all the offense stuff, and I talked about that last week, you know, all the lessons that I learned from watching their offense. And so this week's project has been going back and watching other, you know, parts of the Georgia defensive tape to like pick out, all right, let's figure out whether or not the returning Georgia defensive football players can play football. And I have some answers to that question. I'm not completely done yet, but, you know, I could give you a little sneak preview if you wanted to know.
Absolutely.
So here's what the really interesting thing is. I really feel like without a doubt, the best part of Georgia's defense was their defensive line. They had three starters who were just really tremendous. They had Jordan Davis, the really big guy in the middle, who's like, that dude, that dude was built like the Kingpin and moved like Spider-Man. Like, it was just ridiculous. Like, human beings that size should not be able to do that. He should be shearing right. all of his joints out of place every time he makes a cut. And yet, you know, I mean, it's just phenomenal, you know, watching that guy. But he got a lot of the headlines and attention, you know, and as well he might. But the other two guys who should have been getting a lot of attention were Devontae Wyatt, who is another big, you know, he's a 4-eye guy, but he's big enough that he could slide over and play like one technique as well. He was really good. He had that exactly that skill set that you would want for that position. And then also really interesting was number 44, Trayvon Walker, is really interesting because he's so versatile. He is officially a defensive end, and he is as big and strong as you want a defensive end can be. He can definitely contain the end. He can definitely attack the tackle. He's all you would want in a defensive end, but he is also light and fast enough that he can drop into coverage and play like a sort of ersatz OLB. In fact, there's this really cool play that I'm going to put in my article in which both Walker and Nolan Smith, the OLB, drop out into coverage. The pressure comes from the ILB because this is Dan Lanning. Simulated pressure is kind of his deal. Walker winds up tipping the pass, and Smith, the OLB, winds up getting the interception. It's like an all linebacker, you know, pick. You know, everybody involved in making that pick happen was either a linebacker or defensive end. No defensive backs involved. you know, because that's, you know, because that's sort of the magic of this defense, is that it's so versatile. So, like, now all three of those dudes that I've mentioned, Jordan Davis, Devontae Wyatt, and Trayvon Walker, are departing. Yes. And here's the thing, the guys who are playing behind them, that one of them I think is really good, Jalen Carter, number 88. Like, I think he is easily capable of replacing Devontae Wyatt and is like maybe 80% of Jordan Davis, which, like, 80% of Jordan Davis is better than any Pac-12 defensive lineman. Or most anyway. You know, he's the real deal. I don't really have any doubts about him. The problem is the other two guys who got a bunch of play, they're not bad. It's Tramell Walter and Zion Logue. They're not bad at all. Again, they'd be starters at every Pac-12 team. But the thing is, like, they're just Jalen Carter light. You know, they're just like, you know, second and third version of Jalen Carter, or Devontae Wyatt. Like, they really are. It does not appear. And maybe, you know, maybe I'll find out they have somebody waiting in the wings like this, but at least, you know, for my film study at this point, it doesn't appear like they've got another superhuman freak like Jordan Davis. And I mean, like, how could you expect there to be?
Right.
But it also doesn't appear that they have, like, one of those super versatile, you know, defensive ends like Trayvon Walker. Now they are returning Nolan Smith, the outside linebacker. I think he's their best defensive player that they're returning. Like, I really think he's good. But they're losing another one of their outside linebackers, Adam Anderson. He has some legal trouble. I actually need to look up exactly what his status is. I think it's bad. So anyway, like, you know, and then they're also losing all three of their inside linebackers. They play two inside linebackers at any given moment, but they were pretty liberally rotating between those three guys. It'd be, you know, like A and B, and then B and C, and then A and C, you know what I mean? But they're losing all three of them. And, like, you know, the only reps that went to anybody else were, you know, garbage time reps, and those are pretty low quality. They're losing their starting nickelback, but they bring back the backup nickelback. They're losing their starting, you know, defensive, you know, traditional safeties. They're bringing back, you know, two guys who are rotating at the other position. They're losing, you know, one of their cornerbacks who basically got, you know, who played on every single snap. They are on the other side of the field. It was actually interesting. They had two guys. The first guy who started was Amir Speed. He wound up getting surpassed midway through the season by a true freshman, Keely Ringo, who Oregon fans may recall. Oregon and Georgia went down to the wire in the recruitment of that guy. So it was really interesting to see a true freshman beat out a more established player. Amir Speed is transferred out. I think we all know why. So, you know, no doubt that Ringo will be, you know, the full-time starter. I think that, and I mean, I'm not really trying to disrespect him at all here. Like, and he was a true freshman. You have to take any true freshman cornerback performance with a grain of salt and understand that they always get better their sophomore year, like, substantially. Like, that's the biggest jump. So I'm not really trying to run down Keely Ringo here, but it simply as a statement of fact of the whatever, you know, I think that it was 20 different human beings that they were regularly playing, you know, prior to garbage time on the defense. Like, I think that Keely, if you had to, like, make a ranked list out of those 20 dudes from strongest to weakest, where strongest would be Jordan Davis, the guy in the bottom of that list would be Keely Ringo. And, like, he's the only returning cornerback that they have with some experience, and, like, and that it was a somewhat problematic 2021 season. So, like, man, they are missing a lot, you know, from their defense. Some positions I think they'll be better off than other, you know, like, I don't think they're going to have any problems with, you know, with the nickelback situation. I think they'll probably be fine at the other, you know, traditional defensive backs situations. I think they'll be fine at outside linebacker because Nolan Smith and Robert Beal are really good, and that you really only need one or two, you know, in that system, and they've got it. I think, you know, Jalen Carter, the defensive lineman, is going to be pretty good, but, like, I think I'm done. on, you know, listing all the dudes that like I have a high degree of confidence in. Like everybody else is sort of like, I guess we'll find out, because they really only played during garbage time, and garbage time is garbage time for a reason. There's, and then of course, you know, it's hard to quantify this, but like losing Dan Lanning, you know, like who I right. sort of think, like, I know, you know, any Oregon fan is going to think this, of course, but like, I feel like I have accumulated a good deal of evidence that indicates that Lanning was the secret sauce, that like his
wow.
maybe intuitive understanding, because like that defense has been around for a while and mm-hmm. it's always pretty good. The sort of mint defense that originates at Alabama and, you know, goes with, you know, with Kirby Smart to Georgia, you know, like I feel like the difference, you know, the best version that I saw of it was the one that A, had Dan Lanning figuring out when you should blitz and from where and how to use simulated pressures, and B, had superhuman athlete Jordan Davis, you know, at the front of it. And neither of those things are going to obtain for Georgia in 2022. So I don't know, man. I kind of, you know, I still don't really know what to think about Oregon's offense, but like, man, I kind of think that's going to be a more competitive matchup than a lot of people think.
Well, you sound hopeful. And so the other thing, of course, the other side of it, of course, is like you say, we don't really know what to think of Oregon's offense. The good thing is that we have at least some coaches on Lanning and then on the offensive side of the ball who understand the defense. They understand what that defense is sure, trying.
The double agent Dan Lanning theory.
Yeah, exactly. And that doesn't mean that, you know, Georgia can't make changes or run things a little bit differently or disguise what, you know, what they're trying to do. But, you know, the fact of the matter is that we should have, that Oregon should have a little bit better insight into the defense that Georgia's going to run than they would have if they kept Cristobal or they'd hired some completely unrelated head coach to replace him.
Oh man, I haven't even contemplated that hypothetical for a while now. I mean, like Dan Lanning was hired before they even played, you know, before Georgia was even done with their season.
Right.
You know, like I haven't been thinking about the alternate timeline in which, you know, in which Lanning is not Oregon's head coach for months and months and months, man.
Like, I live in alternate timelines. Yeah, right. I mean, that's the only thing that works for me.
Yeah. So I, you know, stay tuned, everybody. It's going to, you know, I will publish my full Georgia preview. And when I say Georgia preview, I mean, unlike what's Dan Lanning's defense about, you know, article that I published earlier this month, this article that I will publish, you know, the week before the game, probably like sometime in the last couple of days of August, you know, the Monday, the 29th or Tuesday, the 30th, maybe, because the game is on Saturday, the 3rd. So like a couple of days in advance of the game, I will publish my, you know, Georgia preview article in which I will actually run down, you know, who the returning personnel, you know, is. Well, it'll look like all the other preview articles that I write about teams, you know, it'll have a bunch mm-hmm. of film clips about like here, this dude is probably going to be the starter and here's his strengths and weaknesses. And they like to do this in this situation. And so that works when the offense do this, but you can attack them if they do that, you know, it'll be a sort of a strategic planning document as I enjoy writing. I've got a lot to write about. You know, Georgia gave me a lot of film to work with. A lot of it is very interesting. I've enjoyed the project, certainly. I guess, you know, if I have a takeaway message at this point, you know, before I write my article, for listeners of the podcast, your little bonus that you get for listening to it, my takeaway would be like, I watched what every advanced statistician concluded is the greatest defense to ever play college football. And
wow.
I at the end of that project, knowing that Oregon has to play them in the opener, my response is not cringing in terror or shaking in my boots. My response is like, yeah, they're pretty good at this and this and this. I think it would be a mistake to attack them in this way and that way. I think they're vulnerable here and there. I think that, you know, replacing this unit is going to be a problem. You know, like, I am going into this project the same way that I go into, you know, many of the projects that I write about. I sort of feel the same way writing about Georgia, or as I sit down to start writing about Georgia, as I did when I sat down to start writing about Ohio State last year. This is like, yeah, this is a really good team. Here are the areas where they're vulnerable. Mm-hmm. I certainly can't, you know, predict that Oregon is definitely going to win that game just because Oregon beat Ohio State and Columbus, but like, sort of where my gut's at.
Yep, they've shown they can do it.
Yeah,
I mean, a different team, obviously, both playing a different team and a different team coming out of Eugene, but the program has shown it can go on the road and beat a big opponent in their home stadium.
Yeah. Like an elite blue blood, you know, yeah. And they're not going to be playing in Athens. They're going to be playing in Atlanta, but you know,
right.
What's the difference anyway?
It's a home game for Georgia.
You know, my takeaway is not like Oregon fans don't watch this game. It's going to be painful. Like that's not my takeaway at all.
Good. Excellent.
All right. I think that's going to do it for us for this podcast. Any closing thoughts for us, Slurms?
Just hope everybody can get out to the scrimmage on Saturday. Should be interesting to see what the results of that are and how people are plugged into slots based on the competitions that have been happening.
All right. Okay. Take care, everybody. We'll catch you on the flip side.